Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is astrophysicist Dr. Ethan Siegel. Ethan,
hi there, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for being on the show. It's great to have you. Delighted that you were able to join us.
Yeah, it's always exciting to get to talk to people who are interested in space science, the universe, and I just happen to be on a Mac right now and throughout most days in my life.
Cool, cool. The listeners know I have a background in astrophysics as well, so this is going to be a real geek fest.
Let's get right into it then.
Okay, so in the first half of the show, I like to ask the guests about their background. And it's always a fascinating story to hear about how people who become physicists and astrophysicists become inspired. So tell us about what happened. What was that trigger point, the bingo moment that led you into, you know, it's very hard work to get a PhD in astrophysics. You have to be very motivated.
You know, it is, and that's a really good point. You know, like a lot of people, I sort of went through my youth having a lot of different interests in a lot of different things. I studied a lot of different things in college. I wound up triple majoring. Physics was one of those majors. But afterwards, I wasn't really sure what it was I wanted to do. I took a year off after college. I had taken the physics GREs, you know, just in case I ever wanted to go to grad school in that. And I took a job teaching high school physics. And that's what I was doing for a while. And much like being a parent, I think being a teacher is one of those jobs that you really, really, really should love it and want it very bad if you're going to do it. Because even the people who do love it and who want it very bad will tell you it's one of the most difficult things you can choose. So for me, it was while I was doing that, while I was teaching, while I was in a job that I liked some aspects of it, but was frustrated at some other aspects of it. It really made me think of, wow, what is it I'd rather be doing with my life? What is it I'd rather be learning about, rather be studying, rather be working on? And I remembered that there was this whole story of the universe, of how it got to be this way, about what caused the Big Bang and how all the mechanics of that worked. And as I was researching it, I realized that this was not in the realm of theology or philosophy anymore. There was a science behind this. This was knowledge. This was something we could figure out how it worked and where it came from and where it was headed. And there was a whole suite of evidence for why it was this way and not any way else. And I realized that this was something for myself. I wanted to be on the other side of the education desk. I wanted to be learning about all of this. I wanted to absorb as much of it as I could, because this was something that I don't think I had realized until that moment when I was 22 years old teaching in a high school in Los Angeles, that no, this is something I want to go learn about for myself. And that's what led me to grad school. And I was one of the very few people who, as soon as I was accepted to grad school, as soon as I started my first day there, I knew exactly what I wanted to do.
Did things like Cosmos and Carl Sagan or the Apollo program play into any of this?
Well, I'm a little too young for the Apollo program. I was born in 1978, but Carl Sagan's Cosmos was definitely a major, it definitely had a major impact on me, you know, recognizing that this was a hugely grand story that we were a part of, that this is something that maybe was in the realm of philosophers and poets and theologists for a long time, that now those frontiers had been pushed back. And instead of having questions and possibilities, we had answers and new questions that were coming up. You know, Carl Sagan and his work with Cosmos was one of those shining lights for me that really helped point me in the direction I'm headed right now.
Cool, cool. I wanted to ask you about, and this is something the listeners have told me they're interested in, tell me about your feelings about the computers that you use, the kinds of choices that you make.
You know, when I was younger, I was very much a PC person in the 1990s. I was really excited about just getting the most computational bang for my buck and having that be my main concern. And And as I've gotten older and, you know, technology has pretty much evened out in some ways, having computational power is important to me, especially when I run large-scale simulations of structure in the universe or dark matter or interactions between particles. Being able to code and compile that code and run that code, you can pretty much do that on any machine. I did most of that, honestly, on Unix and Linux boxes. In 2007, I got my very first Mac. It was a classic white MacBook, and I was really impressed at how seamlessly the Unix functionality worked on it, and was able to do all my work, all my compiling, all my coding, run any simulations I wanted.
But open up a terminal window or run GCC.
Or G++ if you're a C++ programmer, which I was when I started. But I think the biggest thing for me that really led me to, you know, I'm on my third Mac right now, that led me to stick with it is the quality of the interface. As I've gotten more into teaching and presenting the story of the universe to people and working in visuals and making videos and podcasts and doing other science communication things that are really multimedia focused as opposed to just writing and coding, the Mac really lets me do this all in one. I don't have to load some clunky, cumbersome program like Microsoft Office or Star Office or Open Office and try and figure out their PowerPoint or their presentation thing. I can use Keynote, which I'm really happy about. If I want to do image editing or video editing or audio editing, you know, the Mac just has these native tools that are fantastic for it. So for me, the reason I'm a Mac person now is I'm just in love with this combination of computational power, access to Unix, Linux, that sort of environment through a terminal. I use X11. I don't know what other people prefer. But
there's even a Fitz application for the Mac, I think.
There are. If you're a...
Fitz is an astronomical image format. Listeners like JPEG, similar.
If anyone has ever worked with the cosmic microwave background, if you've looked at that leftover glow from the Big Bang, that famous image of the cold spots and the hot spots, which correspond to the regions that are overdense in the universe that'll grow into stars and galaxies and clusters, and underdense, the regions that'll become the great cosmic voids, those maps are made using the FITS program, and then we have all sorts of algorithms and packages we can overlay on top of it and process it with. So you see a pretty picture when you look at that, but what really excites an astrophysicist about that is all the information that picture is just, you know, a representation of. But all that information encoded there is what really tells us about where the universe comes from, what it's made of, and how it got to be the way it is today. And you can pretty much do it all on a Mac combined with the visualization tools. I'm pretty happy with it.
Yeah, I am too. I am talking to you on a Mac, and I'm using Audio Hijack, and we're recording on Skype, and everything generally goes pretty well on a Mac. With, you know, of course, as everybody knows, I write with the Mac Observer, and so we have to do a lot of image processing ourselves, and we all do podcasts, and we just really enjoy using our Macs for things like that. Have you had a chance to work with any supercomputers?
I have worked with supercomputers in the past, although it's long enough ago that I worked with supercomputers that... you know, that's sort of the funny thing is you think about what was a supercomputer 15 years ago, and today, like, your computer is as powerful as 15 years ago's supercomputer. So, you know, what that really means in terms of physics is it used to be a big deal to simulate a million particles at once in a simulation. And, you know, then 10 or 15 years ago, it was a big deal to simulate a billion particles at once. And as Moore's Law has continued, we can do simulations now with a trillion or 10 to the 12 particles in a single simulation.
On a Mac Pro, for example, with 12 teraflops of power.
You probably could, depending on how many interactions you needed to model between them. I tend to go on the small side of things, and by small I mean, well, if my computer can handle 100 billion particles, let me start with 1 billion and do that nice and fast, and then see if it's worth having it take 100 times as long or 100 squared times as long, depending on what I'm doing, to see if that extra factor of 10, that extra factor of 100 in precision and power is actually worth it. Because sometimes you just want the answer quickly, and there's no need to waste your computing time and waste your time in general if being precise to a lower level, at a lower level of precision is sufficient to give you information about what you want. You have to remember, when you're doing simulations, when you're doing these large computations, you're not getting the exact answer. You're making an approximation of your answer. You're running things to get at a certain class of phenomena.
And the simpler things are at the beginning, the more comfortable you are with the complexity of the answer at the big scale.
That's true as well. I think the important thing is to remember there's no need to go to, you know, seven decimal places of an answer if you're going to be happy getting three.
Yeah, and if you have no way of figuring out whether the seven decimal places is right.
Well, that's true as well. If all you have are your simulations and you're relying on that for the answer, you'll be happy with three significant figures.
I just saw an article today in the Orange County News. It'll probably show up in Particle Debris on Friday, maybe, about Kip Thorne and using visualization to make up for our inability to digest complex mathematics. And of course, that was showcased in the movie Interstellar, where there were some pretty sophisticated visualizations of complex gravitational phenomena in a beautiful visual way that can in turn lead to physical intuition about some things.
I think that's a really important point. You know, there are people who work on that intersection of strong field general relativity and what you would see. Andrew Hamilton at University of Colorado has done some really fantastic simulations on what it would look like as you fell into a black hole. And he's done this for different classes of black holes, for Schwarzschild or non-rotating black holes, for Kerr rotating black holes, for Reiser-Nordström or black holes that have a mass and an electric charge. And these black holes all look different to you as you fall in. But because this is so far out of our experience, because this is so divorced from, you know, our everyday experience, from what we would encounter, this is the sort of thing where if you want an accurate intuition, seeing a visually accurate simulation can help you develop that. And I think that was true in the movie Interstellar as well, where we dealt with a very rapidly rotating massive black hole that was used to help us both travel through time and travel through space to help us find a better home than the Earth we may or may not have ruined in that movie.
Maybe. Well, this is a good place for us to take a break, because when we come back, I want to talk to you about some articles that you've written that were very good, and I just want to kind of walk through them and introduce the listeners to some exciting ideas and concepts. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And back to the show. Thank you, Kelly. So in the second half of the show here, as I said, I want to ask you about some things. And having an astronomy background myself, it's exciting to see all these developments. And one article that you wrote that was really clear and really explained a lot was how we use lasers to eliminate turbulence in the atmosphere. Now, astronomers on land have always been plagued with atmospheric turbulence and atmospheric effects that affect images. And that's why we built the Hubble Space Telescope, to get above all that air. But we've got some new techniques, and I want you to tell us about it.
You know, the new techniques you're talking about are called adaptive optics, and this is actually a pretty old idea. If you've ever looked up at the night sky and seen the stars twinkling, we didn't know really for sure until we developed human spaceflight that the reason the stars twinkle is because of turbulence in the atmosphere. We had thought that perhaps it's turbulence in the atmosphere, or perhaps there are interstellar gas clouds that starlight is passing through that are causing stars to twinkle. And it wasn't until we launched human beings into space and we saw, nope, the stars are not twinkling from up here, that we said, aha, it's the atmosphere. The atmosphere is why stars twinkle. Well, the twinkling might be beautiful to us, but if you want to take detailed imagery of distant stars, distant stellar systems, distant galaxies, you need a way to, you know, compensate for that, because going to space, sending a telescope to space, is expensive and it's hard, and it's got a lot of challenges logistically. So what we can say instead is, well, mirrors are good enough and telescopes are good enough and our techniques are good enough that if we say, I'm going to point my telescope at a point in the sky where, at a region in the sky where I know I've got a star that's a point of light right over there, and if I look at this image I get, it's going to not look like a point. It's going to have distortions and speckles, and it might turbulently move all over the place. So what we can do with this adaptive optics is we can take that light and we can say, okay, here's the signal I'm receiving. And I know at the end, this signal should just be a single point of light. So what I can do is I can make a copy of this signal. I can delay part of it and send the other part into an image processor that'll say, okay, if I see this speckle pattern and I know it should be this single star at this location, I can do, you know, if you know Fourier transforms, you know how to convolve something, you can basically make a reverse mirror that will undo the effect of atmospheric turbulence, that will take that speckle pattern and converge everything back into a single point
with
that corresponds
to a star.
With a very
fast computer.
It does have to be a very fast computer, but you have an actual physical mirror. Because what you do is you take that signal and you use it to make a certain shaped mirror that you then take that copy of the light you make, that delayed light, and you shine it through that mirror. And so you not only get that guide star, you know, transformed back into a point, but you get any other signals you have in that field of view transformed back into what they are. So if you're looking at a distant galaxy, you're going to see that distant galaxy. If you're looking at a supernova billions of light years away, you're going to see that supernova as it was, instead of the speckle pattern that you can't resolve. The new advance that we've talked about is sometimes you don't have a good star to be your guide star where you're looking. Sometimes you need to make an artificial star. So what we do is we shoot a sodium laser up at the sky, because 60 miles up in our atmosphere is a very thin layer of sodium atoms. So if you shine a sodium laser up there, it's going to excite the atoms. And when the atoms de-excite down, they emit light of a very particular wavelength in a very particular spot. And you can use that as your artificial guide star. The most advanced adaptive optics system uses four separate lasers at four different corners of any image. So you can image whatever you want in the center and have these four separate points that will help you make this reverse mirror you need in real time to account for the effect of atmospheric turbulence.
So you have to have actuators on the mirror to actually bend it a little bit.
This is a very special type of mirror that is made up of, I think, tens of thousands of individual segments that have that are both movable and steerable in different orientations. So it's this, you know, actuator is, I think, actually overly simplified for what for the system they have in place. It's a real-time adaptive optics system that is constantly moving all these different segmented parts of a very small mirror around to undo the distortion of the atmosphere.
And that's how we get some of these great astronomical photos that you see on various websites and on the news. That's very interesting. It's a great advance in astronomy, and with larger telescopes, as you've mentioned in your article, coming online soon, we're going to get much more light gathering power combined with adaptive optics than we could have ever done with a Hubble Space Telescope. You can't put telescopes with that big a mirror in space and do optics, although the Webb telescope is a lot bigger because it's infrared. That's another topic. Let's move on to something else. Recently, there was a big news about the LIGO experiment discovering gravitational waves. Tell us the difference between just simple gravity and a gravitational wave, and tell us what LIGO discovered.
Well, so the LIGO experiment was actually a huge coup, right? One of the predictions of Einstein's relativity is that space itself acts like a fabric, and just like you have electromagnetic radiation, which is we know better as light, when you have a charged particle accelerate in a magnetic field, it produces electromagnetic radiation or light, and you can see that. Well, when you have a gravitational source, which we just call a mass, accelerating in a gravitational field or moving in the presence of another mass, it's going to emit gravitational radiation. So this is not light. This is not anything you can see with a telescope or a radio dish. This is something that's a ripple in the fabric of space itself. It also moves at the speed of light because the speed of gravity is the speed of light. But this is a new type of radiation itself. So, for example, if you look at the Earth orbiting around the sun, you would think, oh, Kepler's laws, this is just going to make an ellipse and go around the sun forever and ever. Well, in Newton's laws of gravity, that would be true. But in general relativity, you actually have this problem of, as you are making this orbit, as you are a mass moving in a gravitational field, you're emitting gravitational radiation, and very slowly your orbit is decaying. So if you say, oh no, that means the Earth is going to spiral into the sun, how long do I have? Well, the sun is a small mass for general relativity, and we're at a really large distance at 93 million miles away. So you're talking about 10 to the 150 years. We're pretty safe for that.
I think so. Considering the lifetime of the sun is only 10 to the ninth, times 10 to the ninth years. So we're cool.
Right.
But so how is this wave detected?
Well, so what you do is you need a really extreme system, like either two black holes or two neutron stars that aren't millions of miles apart from each other, but just a few kilometers apart from each other. So what happens is you get these two massive black holes, is what LIGO saw, of about 30 solar masses each, and they spiral into one another. And it's only 200 milliseconds, the final 200 milliseconds of this merger, that we were able to see. Because what LIGO did was it built these two laser arms that were perpendicular to one another and reflected the light back and forth 1,000 times. When a gravitational wave passes through something, it's like you imagine taking a tennis ball and squishing it from the top so that the top and bottom sides compress down and the center bulges out. And then you compress it on the sides so that the center bulges in and the top and bottom bulge out. And you go back and forth like that. That's what gravitational radiation will do. So if you say, well, these two merging black holes, how much did they compress the whole Earth by? And the answer is about 1/1000th of the width of a proton. So not a whole lot. But we've built these laser arms so sensitive that they were able to detect it for 200 milliseconds or about 6 or 7 cycles of this orbit. 6 or 7 orbits of these two black holes right before they merge together. So that's what we do, is we have theorists construct what are the different templates for different types of mergers we could have. We understand general relativity. We understand what objects are out there in space, and we construct these different models for what sort of signal LIGO should see. And when we see something that's above the noise, we look for it in multiple detectors, at the one in Hanford, Washington, and the one in Livingston, Louisiana, and we look to see, are they synced up? We have the Virgo detector coming online in Italy. We have Kagra detector coming online in Japan in a few years. And India has just announced they're building one as well.
What is the purpose of extra detectors?
Extra detectors, the real goal is, if you want to know where something happened in the sky, you need at least 3 separate simultaneous detections. We do this with earthquakes on Earth. It's called triangulation. And it's called triangulation because you need 3 separate locations to be able to pinpoint exactly where something occurred. So if we can get 3 separate detectors that'll tell us exactly where something occurred, then the real goal is we're going to see gravitational waves first. If we have neutron stars merging, we're going to see gravitational waves before we see anything else. If we then tell our telescopes in a matter of seconds, hey, point to this location in the sky and see if anything happens, right? This is a new form of astronomy. So yes, we've detected our first gravitational wave, but the real tantalizing potential is to use gravitational wave astronomy and optical astronomy together to give us a whole new window on phenomena in the universe. Do merging black holes produce light? Are merging neutron stars the source of gamma ray bursts? With the combination of gravitational wave astronomy and traditional electromagnetic astronomy, we have the potential to answer these mysteries.
Excellent. Excellent. So in the short time we have left, I wanted to ask you about another article that you wrote about that was very intriguing. Explain quantum entanglement and how it works and how we might or might not be able to use it to our advantage.
Quantum entanglement basically says, if you know how you created 2 entangled particles, then you can know the sum of their properties. For example, if I make 2 particles, an electron and an anti-electron, I would know whether the total of their spin is that the total of their spin has to be 0. So if I take them and I move them really far apart and I measure the spin of one of them to be +0.5, then I know the spin of the other one has to be -0.5. Right, that's entanglement, is if I know something about one of them, then I immediately know the other. Now, electrons exist in this weird, and all particles exist in this weird indeterminate state until you measure it. That's one of the weird things about quantum mechanics, is that things aren't determined until you measure them. So you get this weird superposition of possible realities, and you only actually get one answer when you make that measurement. So what people have had this idea for is, well, can I take 2 particles, entangle them, and then send one of them really far away, go measure something at some distant place, and then look at what I have left here and say, oh, now I've learned what I have over there. And that's a really great idea, but it doesn't quite work. And the reason it doesn't
The reason we hoped it would work was because this communication of states between the entangled particles happens instantaneously, not at the speed of light.
That's a great point. It does happen instantaneously. So if you have an entangled particle and I have an entangled particle and we're a light year away, if you measure yours to be +0.5, then I know mine is -0.5 right away when you make that measurement, not I don't have to wait a year for the speed of light to come and tell my particle, oh, John over there made a measurement. No, like mine will feel that response instantly.
Tantalizing, but there's a problem.
Well, the problem is when I take my particle and I measure, oh, mine is spin minus a half. That means his is plus a half. I don't know whether you made a measurement and broke the entanglement or whether I just measured mine and yours was determined because I measured mine. The only way to know what yours was is to have you come send information to me to say, hey, by the way, mine was plus spin a half. Well, that's going to take the full
year. That's the traditional speed of light. Yeah,
that's limited by the speed of light. Well, so you might say, well, I've got a better idea. How about you're going to take 100 particles with you, 100 entangled particles, and then I'm going to measure 100 of mine. And if I see 50% of them are plus a half and 50% of them are minus a half, then I know you didn't make your measurement. But if I see 100 of mine are all minus a half, then I know, oh, he made all of his plus a half, and now I've got mine. But then you have to face the fact that there's what's called a no cloning theorem. So you would want to do it this way, but it turns out that's not going to work either. There's a difference between you, what you do a light year away of making a measurement, which is when you ask your particle, hey, are you plus a half or are you minus a half? And you forcing a particle into a certain state. If you force it into a certain state, that breaks the entanglement, but it doesn't give me the information about how you forced it. So if you say, I'm going to make a measurement that forces my particle to be plus a half, that doesn't force mine to be minus a half. What you did was you made a measurement and then forced a state. And that's not the same thing. So we've got these ideas of how we'd like to have faster than light communication, but no matter how we try and connive it, nature won't let us send information that way. All we can do is collapse a wave function or make a measurement. We can't force a measurement and have it affect something happening any distance away.
We can't communicate, it looks like, by invoking the features of quantum entanglement, but the fact that the tests we've done so far at moderate distances here on Earth and detecting zero delay tells us that the effect anyway is being transmitted instantaneously. That provides some hint, perhaps, that maybe there's something going on below the level of quantum mechanics, hidden variables or some sort of deterministic structure, perhaps. Is it the Davies effect? Where we suspect that maybe quantum mechanics is just a shimmering reflection of a deeper deterministic reality that determines how things happen, and they happen instantaneously, and they're happening outside the fabric of space-time. What do you think?
There are some things that we know can't be a combination of things. Like you can't have your variables be local and real and deterministic if there are hidden variables. But if you do something like you say you go outside of space-time, which is to say if your variables are inherently non-local, then perhaps there is some version of hidden variables that will work. Then perhaps there is some version of determinism that you can throw in there. This is pretty hard because locality seems to be pretty important for most things in our universe. But there are many different ways in quantum mechanics to get a solution. You can have something that's local or non-local, and it still gives you the same answer. That's deterministic or non-deterministic, and it still gives you the same answer. When you have maybe a dozen different assumptions you can make that all give you the same answer, that sort of leads me to believe you're probably looking at a blind man and an elephant scenario, not at the case where you're saying, oh, well, reality is actually this thing and we just can't perceive it. It's more the case of actually reality is much more complex and varied than anything we've thought of. And perhaps there's some, I don't know whether it's deterministic or not, but perhaps there's a deeper truth about nature that we have yet to realize, because we're only looking at our four dimensions and we're only looking at how things behave with the limitations of what we can observe.
That's right. That's right. There's always hope. And that's why people get excited about researching and theoretical astrophysics, to try to dig into these things. Peter Higgs was able to live long enough to see his theories about the Higgs particle and the Higgs field proven to be correct in the Large Hadron Collider, and got the Nobel Prize in his lifetime for it, along with other gentlemen who worked with him. So it's inspiring. It's awesome. It all starts with your backyard telescope. Sometimes seeing Saturn for the first time, or the moon through a telescope, getting excited. And then there's boundless things that you can do, and research, and all of the things that we talked about. And so I hope the listeners out there, many of them, get inspired to learn more about these things. I think we're going to have to wrap it up. That's all we have time for the show. Ethan, tell us how the listeners can contact you if they wish.
Well, if you'd like to contact me, you can reach me at Starts With A Bang on Twitter. That's my handle, and that's the name of my blog over on Forbes. And if you'd like to check out a copy of my book, it's called Beyond the Galaxy, and it's available at Amazon, and I know you'll have a link through it on your website.
We'll put it in the show notes.
And stay curious about the universe, and I'd love to hear from you.
Cool. Thank you again for being on the show. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.